Welcome to the EMS Handle Podcast, your source for all things EMS. Now let's welcome to the show your hosts, Bradley Dean and David Blevins.
Hello and welcome to another week of the EMS Handoff Podcast. I'm David along with my co-host Bradley Dean. We're ready to get this thing rocking again. Bradley, this time you're traveling. I'm at home. Tell us where you are.
So I'm actually here in Greensboro, North Carolina at the North Carolina EMS Expo. Coming to you just from Myrtle Beach where I got all of this. So it's not because I've had too much bourbon or anything else. It's actually the sun today.
Likely story, you know, it's one of those things. But because you are at the North Carolina EMS Expo, you're hanging out with our guest today. So let's go ahead and introduce Kelly and let's get this thing started.
So I've got Kelly Kirk with us, and there's a lot I could say about him. Most of it probably would not be good for gyms or our podcast. So I'm going to turn it over and let him introduce himself.
Hi, I'm Kelly Kirk. I'm the president and CEO of 911 eLearning. I don't know what you guys want to know about me historically. Whatever you ask the questions, I'll answer them.
How did you get to where you are today?
Oh, wow. Well, you see, it was a blue station wagon with two bubble gum. Oh, never mind.
Yep. It really was. I know exactly where you're at now. I started my career doing this in 95. I was a paramedic. I got my EMT in 92, 93. Circa 1999, I had just graduated my associate's degree program. I ran into my mentor, who was Brian Cyphers, and he had this crazy idea of developing an online course to bridge the certificate paramedics over to associate degree medics, and happened to ask me if it was something I could do when I had absolutely no clue what to do. But I wanted a laptop, and I told him, if you give me a laptop, I'll make it happen. So he just happened to be the right person in the wrong place at the right time or something. I don't know, but that's kind of how I got started developing online classes. I developed those, and then, you know, through trial and error, because in the 90s, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, nobody had really heard of online classes. It wasn't a thing.
Right.
So, you know, I just did what I thought I had to do, because I'm the kind of student who tries to beat the system. So I built courses for me to beat me. So my courses were built where you had two options. You either learned something or you failed the class. And, you know, that has morphed over the years. I ended up doing my master's degree in instructional design for online learning. And I'm currently working on my dissertation for the same. So over all the years, I ended up being director of distance education at one of the local community colleges before I finally started the company. And here we are, 10, 11 years later, something like that, from the company. If you can keep track of all of that.
And that is all the time we have for the podcast. Thanks for joining. No. All right. Well, so, you know, you hit an interesting time and a lot of things that you kind of put. And as we were talking in preparation for this, I was making mention that in writing my current continuation self-study for the Committee on Accreditation for our paramedic program, one of the things that got tossed in there is the need to have an action plan for unanticipated program interruption. And obviously, we're coming off one of the largest this country has seen affecting P-12 and higher ed at a moment's notice. And I go back to March of 2020, and I remember this quite vividly because, one, we were in the middle of our spring break, and myself and my clinical coordinator were in my office planning up on my whiteboard when we, you know, we've been tracking COVID and the development of it. And next thing you know, we get an email from our president that says they're extending our spring break another week. And any faculty that need anything from their offices, get it now because we're not coming back. And I'm like, all right. So I'm not planning on doing a whole lot because I was at this point in time not really thinking it was going to be that big a deal. We were still very early on here in the States and obviously proved extremely wrong. And our students were off campus for the rest of March and most of April. And we finally got back in May to finish up some of the stuff for our EMT and AEMT programs. And luckily we had through the summer to finish up for our paramedic program before they were to test. So, you know, let's start there. So, you know, what I'm going to start with is based on what you have seen in your roles, what did COVID do to EMS education across this country?
I think there's really two big things that are going to come out of that have come out of the COVID event, if you would. And it is distance education. It proved that things can be done that we had been saying for years, that you can do things effectively online. And then it also proved that things can be really crummy online because, like I said at the beginning, 1999, when I was thrown into that, there really wasn't anybody to mentor me or your distance education or any of that stuff to help us out. So COVID comes and P12 and so on, you know, again, same exact situation. And so you had all these teachers and educators that were thrown back into an abyss that they had no clue how to work, and they didn't have the teams. And of course, your distance ed, those that did have distance ed teams were completely overwhelmed. So, you know, they wasn't able to help them build the program. So the best thing that's come out of it for education is to show that there are more than one modality that is effective, because they were able to make those changes and do so many distance things. I mean, you still have people that are not working from home or that are not working from traditional environments. They're working from home. You've got televisits now that didn't used to happen prior to the COVID event. So, yeah, a lot of that stuff, you know, has come out. But again, the bad part of it is we have to fight the ones that were the naysayers in the beginning, and then COVID comes around. You have people thrown in the wrong environment who put out stuff that is the best they can do, and it wasn't as effective as it could have been. So those naysayers just got some additional evidence for that. So it's quite the conundrum that we're stuck in.
Well, it's kind of funny that you mentioned that, because my undergrad and graduate degrees are both done through a distance education program. And I would tell you that in both of those, my undergrad is a dual major in fire service administration and fire prevention, and my master's is in emergency and disaster management. And what I'll tell you is, you know, it's very dependent on who you have as to exactly what those classes entailed. And I would tell you that at that point in time, the office that we're in now, or that I'm in now, was our office during COVID, where we were teaching from, and my wife is also a professor at a different university in our area, and I ended up teaching an advanced EMT class, and we were in the midst of trying to, one was on one side of the office and the other was on the other side. We're trying with our headphones and realized that wasn't working, so one of us converted the dining room to a classroom, and I'm one that very much likes to walk and talk when I present, so sitting there kind of caused me some issues. So, all right. So I'm gonna start with the second thing that you made mention here, because I want to spend more time on the positive side. So you said one of the things that this did was show us that things can be very crummy, and so you kind of alluded to that. But I think this again turns us into one of our positives in just a second. But why were some of these things during COVID crummy?
again, it's when I first started doing it, again, there weren't any models to look at. People didn't have anything to look at and to show them how to do things. So we were struggling trying to figure it out. And with COVID coming in, we run into the exact same circumstance where traditional educators who really didn't want anything to do with distance education or any electronic education or any of that stuff, they were phenomenal educators, been teaching for years, some of the best in the world. But now they're thrown into an environment that they've never had any part in. So again, you're moving back in time and you're putting them in a box and expecting them to build a house that they've never seen. So that's why it turned out they did the best they could. Some of them did recorded videos. Some of them would record over PowerPoint. Some of them just write lecture notes down and send them to the students. All of that stuff, if put together in the right way, is exactly what you need. But individually, it makes it more difficult because you're only addressing one particular thing. So without having the tools and the schematics that they had from years of experience, it was less than favorable.
So that reminded me when our school system, P-12, I had somebody, a student that was in middle school and one that was in high school at the time. And our middle school, we had to go by on the Friday afternoon, and they had a pickup line. And at the end of that 2020 school year, and they picked up packets of stuff, and they weren't going to be graded packets, but they were packets that they were handing off. And, and these were substantial, like, it was every subject for the entire week. So it was a pretty substantial packet. And one of my son's teachers, who he actually thought didn't like him, and really the only thing was is she thought he could do more, actually came up and said, not only are you getting your sixth grade packet, but I think you actually need, you're smart enough that you could do the seventh and eighth grade packet. So he came home with a massive stuff. And that was it. Like, it was a packet. There was no instruction. He knew it wasn't going to be graded, so he didn't spend much time on any of it. So the reason why I say this is his teachers at that point in time were very capable and knowledgeable in the classroom and were able to get that through. And so one of the things that you're talking about is this isn't necessarily kind of put together with that you can't teach old dog new tricks kind of thing. This is everybody. So there was a lot of educators of all ages, of all technologically savvy and unsavvy individuals that were tossed into here. Like I said, we luckily got an extra week of time off before we were expected to be back in the classroom. So we were able to do some prep somewhat, but there were older professors that could do it right and do it wrong. There were younger ones that could do it right and do it wrong. Am I right?
Yeah, 100%. And, sending the paperwork, just to kind of give you an idea, distance education is not a new thing. No. Correspondence courses have been around forever. And that's exactly what happened here is with, you receiving a packet, those children's courses had been turned into a correspondence course.
So let's talk about the difference between correspondence course and online course. We're going to focus on trying to do it right.
Okay.
So if I'm teaching an online course and I send out the stuff, I've got it uploaded to, Moodle, Blackboard, whatever platform we're using, and a student's going through this stuff and they've got a question. What is a reasonable time frame in order to keep this, as real as possible for me to respond back to them if they've got a question?
For you as an educator?
Yes.
Okay. That's a really good question. And having been a director of distance education, everybody's a little different. It's easier. A reasonable time frame would be without weekend. Let me answer the question first, and then I can go back. Without it being a weekend, 24 to 48 hours is reasonable time frame. Weekends can be more. Now, what is most important, and this is with my background in instructional design, in our company, everybody knows the term NAVCOM-X. That is what is important in any course, period. NAVCOM-X, navigation, communication, and expectations. And those with just those three things, the packet of information that was sent home for you would have been successful. The online recorded PowerPoint would be successful. Any written lecture notes would be successful. But the students, first and foremost, have got to be shown how to navigate the content, to navigate, whether it's online, whether it's in a book, whatever it is. They need to be shown where this stuff is. Then you need to communicate with them what is expected of them. So those two kind of go hand in hand. There needs to be communication between the student and the instructor, and the student and the material. So the students need to know the expectations, what should be done. They need to be able to find the information, and they need to be able to communicate between all of those things and include the instructor. Now, as the instructor, you communicate what those expectations are with your email question. You tell them up front in the syllabus, Monday through Friday, you send me an email between this time and I will respond in this time. Or we use a classroom questions discussion forum so everybody can see the question. So it makes it more realistic, where like a traditional class, you have a class, Bradley has a question, I have the same question. He asks, you answer, I don't have to ask the question. So that's why we use that classroom forum. But either way, whatever communication you use just needs to be communicated to the students. Because if you don't tell them up front that it's going to be up to 48 hours before I reply, then they start panicking. And it just tumbles downhill from there.
And that really boils down to regular classroom management as well. They need to know what those classroom expectations are, which most on-ground classes will have that first day where they put out those expectations. They give you the syllabi. They let you know, this is this, etc. And then, you try to maintain to that to the best of your ability. We understand emergencies occur. That's why we're talking about this right now. We're going, nobody knew what to anticipate in March of 2020, and it kind of changed things dramatically after that. And I think the middle part to that is because I almost think you kind of put an arrow, if we were doing this as a formula, both directions, because the navigation comes with your communication, but the communications comes because of the expectations, and it kind of goes. It's kind of like the bicarbonate buffer system. You got dual arrows on both sides. And so, but the middle part of that is communication. So, all right. So you've already started that transition with that NAVCOM-X, which I absolutely love that. I wrote that down in my notes. And so, so let's get into the side that we proved that it could work. So how can Kelly Kirk say that this model worked through your experiences?
That really boils down to just basic instructional design, and that's the assessments. Whether it is the written assessment, the outcomes is really what's important. It worked because the students were able to achieve the goals that they wanted. May not have been the most successful and the easiest way to do it, but it worked and they were able to achieve those goals. And then over the time period, the instructors that really embraced the technology and the new methods got better and better and better and started seeking tools so that they could improve what they were doing. And they realized, oh gosh, this is working, and they are getting it. So I'm very notorious for saying, I have a famous saying that there is nothing I cannot teach online except a student who doesn't want to learn. If you don't want to learn, I can't teach you. Other than that, it doesn't matter what it is. And I've got plenty of examples out there. There's a person right now who's on American Idol, taught himself how to sing and play guitar by watching videos.
So I've got two things with that. First, very similar, and I've used a very similar analogy that you have. I said there are some individuals that we come up can in contact with that we could give them a book list and their objectives, and they could teach themselves how to be physicians and be doggone good ones, right? It's funny, if you listen to some of the med schools, you go into some of their classes and they're given kind of an objective, but then they end up studying on their own. But then you've got the other student on the other side of the spectrum that you could give them everything, every ounce of your attention. You could be right there with them. You can do extra study sessions with them, and they just never get it. And so I think this is kind of interesting that you make mention. The opportunity is there for you to know what's going on. The second part to that is I was listening to somebody today on social media, and they were talking to somebody that was in the process of finishing up a EMT initial education course, was looking at National Registry coming up, both written and practical. And they're like, you know, it's kind of funny they're asking this question now, but like, what should I study to prepare? I love the response first. And he's like, you know, your course material, you should have been involved with that this whole time, which the course material, whether you're online or on ground, is the same materials. And then he's like, you know, in addition to that, I found some people to stream through the different platforms, whether it's YouTube or some of the different social medias. And they're like, I've gotten the light bulb has clicked. And that's kind of what I've said to some of my students. Like, sometimes you get together in your own little study group. I've never been a big group study person, but I've participated in some of those sessions, and you just watch somebody's light bulb go off because a student said something in just a little bit different way than Bradley or myself, or you may have mentioned it. All of a sudden, you know, it dings, and it doesn't matter why the light turned on. The light just needed to turn on. So I absolutely love that. I'm going to put it this way. There's a lot of stuff that I can do with the human body. I'm pretty efficient on that. I've done it for 2.5 decades now, pretty much. But I have found that even these techniques can help you. 2 years ago, right before Christmas, our stove went out in the middle of cooking dinner. Luckily, I was 90% of the way done. I was able to get it done. And I assessed what was going on. I got on my computer and I GTS'd or Googled that stuff. And by golly, I got on Amazon and bought a $29 part. And after Christmas, fixed that thing like a champ. My mom was quick to point out that I was a people medic, not an appliance medic. And she's like, I'll buy a new oven. I'm like, nope, this thing's working. And, you know, I think, you know, and it was because I watched a couple of videos on Google or on YouTube. And was able to pick it up and do that. So I think that's kind of a good way. So let's talk about this. I'm going to kind of talk about this next part in two different ways, because I know that you do have some initial and continuing education standpoints. But say a program like mine, mine is completely on ground. Now, I will put a disclaimer out there. Every state needs to check with their state office of EMS or whoever their authorizing body is to teach these classes. In the state of Tennessee, we're restricted to on-ground classes unless something like COVID comes about. There are some restrictions that we do have. But as I'm sitting here writing this action plan for unanticipated programmatic interruption, you know, I need to be thinking about some of these things. So how would I prepare my faculty members in the event, you know, let's say I had to hire a whole new staff. None of them went through COVID, so none of them have experienced this before. And we have something like this happen again. So what are some of your ideas to preparing individuals to take this from an on-ground to an online cohort and not skip a beat?
Okay. First and foremost, it's called a hybrid class. And that's where a portion of it is online and a portion of it is traditional. With a traditional course, in your case, what you need is a learning management system that you keep all of your materials in. So instead of teaching the students to through the learning management system, you use it as a repository so that if the students want to pull down a lecture, if they want to pull down PowerPoint, or if you want to share, you know, whatever, any handouts that you give them, or if you want to take up papers or even test them through the learning management system, you make that just the regular so that all courses have a companion online piece that's not part of, it's not counted as your classroom hours, but it's the vehicle in which you deliver as much as you can. The syllabus can be put through there, you know, any of your assignments, any of that stuff can be done. And what you're doing is you're teaching the students how to navigate the system. You're teaching the educators how to navigate and put the stuff into the system. So in the event you run into that area, now instead of it being a repository, it's an easy flip of the switch to switch it over and start using it now more as an educational tool.
And so one of the things you made mention, and for some of these educators, you know, this stuff is second nature, but so some of these may be like D2L, Brightspace, Canvas, but you can also use things like Microsoft Teams. You know, you don't have to have a formalized learning management system. Now, most organized universities will have something, or colleges will have something, because that's kind of looked at when you get into your regional accreditations and such. But if you don't have a system like that, you could put together a Teams community in which you put your students in there and you have the same thing. Files go in there. And it may take a little bit more because you have to restrict, you know, certain folders to certain students. So like you said, those submissions aren't available to everybody, but you could build that. So I think that's phenomenal. And I think it's one of those things when you cross to our community of practice anyways, that online learning management system is very similar to the systems that we use when you go into the field as well. You know, we're repositing these patient care documents into these different areas. And then we also have, Bradley, you may be able to, but there are some employee communities in which you put out new policy statements. Their SOPs and their protocols are all available on there. There's email on there. So it's things that are being done within our community of practice and the operations side. So why not do it on the education side anyways? And then you have your in-person lectures. They go and do everything else online. And then if needed, you just switch your videos over to whatever system there as well, right? So, go ahead.
Jump into something, because you mentioned that you watched a YouTube video and then you were able to, you know, order the part that you needed and you were able to fix the stove. So let's talk about this whole thing of, you know, what we do with people is very skill oriented with IVs and airway and cardiac monitoring and everything else. So how do we overcome the challenge of students and participants doing the online course and then being able to actually perform that skill in the field?
I would like to make clarification in being able, the biggest issue that I have run into in the 20 years that I've been doing this, it's not whether they can or cannot perform the skill that people are concerned about, because we can teach them how to perform the skill when we talk about an online course. It's whether or not we can assess their ability to perform that skill. That's the portion that is it's a little different in that case, because I cannot completely assess certain skills without having somebody there that can verify different pieces. It can be done. It can be done through the same way that we're having this conversation. An extra party there. There are all those different things. So to teach them how to do the skill can be done. It depends on which skill it is, as to what equipment they need access to. It becomes cost prohibitive, obviously. But just to teach somebody how to do the skill can be done. It's whether or not we can assess their ability to do it. So again, if they want to learn, they're going to learn. And right. The fact that you mentioned fixing something at home here in North Carolina, about four or five years ago, they were talking about putting a limit on online education in the rules. And they were going to say 50%. Well, there was no empirical evidence as to why 50%. They were just, some people were complaining, some people weren't. There was all these questions. Well, can you do that online? Can you not do that? So they had the community forums, and I stood before the board and I said, so again, I can teach anybody anything online except for those that don't want to learn. And I said, I just want to ask you one question. Have you never went online? Not never, that's great grammar. But have you never gone online and learned how to fix something at your house? Because if you have, you just learned a psychomotor skill through distance education. So the problem is whether or not you can assess their ability to do that. That's the problem that comes in. If they want to learn, if you know how to do it, you can teach them.
Right.
You can teach them, this is what you should feel, this is what should happen, and you show them the videos and you show them all that stuff. It becomes cost prohibitive to do it, but it can be done. It's just whether or not you can assess their ability.
And so with a disclaimer, because that's probably a better way to put it, is can you assess versus what I said, teach, but to assess, their ability. So I know that now on e-learning, when you're doing some of these, refresher courses and everything else, you actually send people to the local community college, wherever it is, mm-hmm. for an actual skills hands-on review and a summative scenario, well, a group of summative scenarios for each one of those courses.
Right.
So that's that whole thing of assessing the individual's ability to do that.
Right. And making the difference between the way that we build courses is whether it is a high stakes course or not. If this is an initial program, whether it's an initial or refresher, if you are going into the system or re-entering into the system, then we have to make sure beyond a shadow of a doubt that you are who you say you are, that you are the person who's taking the test, that you do have the knowledge and the skills that you're supposed to have, because we are certifying that these people are ready to go take care of other people's lives. So those exams and those courses are built to catch anybody who's trying to circumvent the system. Like, we check photo IDs when the students show up to make sure they are who they say they are. They take proctored exams on campus. We, and like Bradley said, we do the skills assessment with them. We do the summative assessment with them. So we make sure that they have those skills. So that's the issue that you run into. Now, if the purpose is continuing education, then it's not as serious on our part for us to make sure that they're completely up and honest and all that. Some of that has got to be put back onto the student and academic integrity. But for those high stakes exams, there's no question we're going to put our eyes on them, and we're going to make sure that we do everything we can to keep them from circumventing the system.
Well, and I absolutely love everything that you just said, because those are conversations we've had over here as well. Because we do have that 50% cap actually on continuing education requirements that was in existence before COVID, was waived during COVID because of the governor's executive orders. And then once those governor's executive orders went away, it came back. And now we're actually issuing an $800 training stipend for anybody that continues or completes a 40-hour training program annually. And we have requirements within that got put into those that they had, so many of them had to be CAP CF5 or in person, with very few or almost none coming through the online education. And like I said, there's a lot of us that have gone through it. I'm like, I was Very, and it goes back, and it really kind of goes back to your kind of two pathways that you already mentioned. It's like there were things that were good and we showed it worked, and then there were things that were kind of crappy, and we judge everything by the crappy side and not. But if we looked, it's like, what would be, how much of it would be good or how much of it would be bad?
You know, part of that, remember, you can do absolutely everything wonderful as a paramedic for your entire career. Never make a single mistake until you make that one mistake. And then everybody remembers by the one mistake. So the other thing I want to point out is that whether it's brick and mortar, whether it's correspondence education, whether it's online education, education is the root of all of it. The modality changes, but the education doesn't. And how that education is delivered in large is still the same way, still has the same concepts and components. You just add a few extra tools to the mix in some online classes. Either way, it's online, distance, or brick and mortar. It's all education.
And the question is, how many of us have had a bad in-person, on-ground class as well?
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
You know, and I think that's one of the things that has to be looked at is, you know, there's bad in-person classes. Right? You know, here's the thing. There are bad in-person classes with professors that are phenomenal. You know, they have a bad day. They come in, you know, there's all kinds of things. And to, again, judge by that one, like you said, 30 years, you've got one instance, and to judge it by that is a bad thing. So, all right. So let's talk about the leadership side to some of these. We've talked a lot about the classroom side. What would you tell a leader? Say you're telling me, you know, I am so against online education. We don't need to do this. But you were coming to sell me on your product there, or really just the online component, however you want to do that. So as a leader that doesn't want that, how would you try to change my mind? How would you say, hey, this is actually a good thing?
It depends on that's a really good question, because I have dealt with that for 20 years now. And it is just like education, it's personalized. That is a very key term. It's the latest, greatest, and it's personalized education. You've got to personalize the response to that leader as to what's important to that particular person. I can prove to you through multiple methods, and I can show you all these. I can show you studies. I can show you, again, it depends on who you're talking to, because some people are going to respond by showing literature. I can show you literature and study after study that shows that there is no significant difference between online education and brick and mortar. But if you're not that kind of person, then I have to approach it from a different perspective to show you, yes, you can learn, and ask just the simple question. Have you gone online to figure out how to put something together? Okay, so you don't own a computer. So have you ever opened up a set of directions and put something together from those directions? That is no different than getting the information from online. You are using something where the instructor is separate from you as the educator. So it's still a distance education. It is a form of distance education. So that's how you have to approach it. You have to determine what is best for the leader. And some people are just stalwart. You're just not going to convince them.
Not just that. I can take any of our QI data and come to you and say, hey, we found this in our peer review. This is what we need. And you could develop a course that hits that. Mm-hmm. So then I can take that and push it out to 150 different employees on their schedule, because it's difficult to get people, you know, that are on four or five different schedules across multiple days in and keep everything consistent. you can add that consistency as a piece of that.
100%. The American Heart Association did that how many years ago? 15 plus, where they took the ability to deliver the education out of our hands and put it all on video. So what they did is they standardized the education that's going out. So now, instead of me delivering the way that I think this ACLS class should be delivered, and Bradley doing it different and you doing it different, we all deliver the exact same thing by putting a video in the, well, showing my age, putting a DVD in. Yeah, I was going into VHS, you know, the beta thing.
Yeah, speaking of which, back in 1999, you recorded me teaching 12 leads.
Yep.
I've still got that somewhere.
Yep. At that point, you couldn't stream media and all that stuff. So that part of it was a correspondence course. We videoed it and emailed it out.
Well, it's kind of funny because, I sit here as we talk about this, and I think back as to what is available. And I think about the story of a guy named Salman Khan. He was a very smart individual. Holds two doctorates, if I remember his story right, an undergrad and graduate, plus his two doctorates. And his brother, or I think it's his brother's family, his niece needed help on homework. They're like, hey, why don't you call your Uncle Sal? And so he started to work with his niece to help with the homework because he was a smart one in the family. He got into some of the concepts that really didn't makes sense to just discuss over the phone. So what did he do? He figured out a way to record himself, put it on YouTube, send it over to his niece. Because at that point in time, YouTube was relatively new. There's no way to really protect it to just one individual. So what happened? Everybody got to start seeing his videos and like, I really understand this concept. And now in 2018, 2019, revenues for his nonprofit organization are $30+ million for Khan Academy work. And Khan Academy now has P-12 education. They have higher education. They got SAT, ACT prep, MCATs, NCLEX, LSAT. He's got a staff of experts from doctors and lawyers and all that, that are focused on helping individuals from all across. I mean, the anatomy and physiology content on there is second to none. People, I doubt seriously that there's not a school across this country that doesn't embed something from the Khan Academy into their education programs, from EMT all the way up to med school. And what is that?
Distance education.
Education, right? The only thing that he really doesn't get into, and now actually it is being done because I think there are some programs within that do have credit, is he's not big on the assessment component of it. It's up to you to learn and really go back to your classrooms. But now, again, because there are guided systems for the P-12 education, really kind of the lower grades, there's some assessments on them. So that's distance ed for free, And so...
And I would say if you were a paramedic or a paramedic student and you haven't gone to Khan Academy, you're doing yourself a disservice.
Dude, I still do it now. I have been for a while.
Their anatomy and physiology stuff is great. It helps you understand, the stuff that you do in our, as a paramedic.
Do you know how I learned to talk about what was in the blood to students and what I do?
You probably do what I did. You went to Khan Academy.
I went to Khan Academy and I watched there. And what do I do? I draw a test tube and I layer out just like he does with the different colors. The only difference is they're sitting in a desk right across from me versus on a camera. And you know what? I talked about it all the time. I'm like 45%, 1%. And they're like, well, and it wasn't until I drew this little test tube. And I don't know why I didn't think about that, but I didn't. Now I do. It's like because, again, some of our learners are, my wife teaches teachers. So, you get into what learning preference you have. And it's like, some people, but in that case, know, it's easy to get across information. It's breaking it down to its simplest form to be able to focus on that. So now, so got through the admin, you know, what about that admin person, Kelly, that is going to his faculty now going, hey, you got to be prepared to go this route if this ever happens again. What's kind of one of your go-to points as to why it's important to use that hybrid setting, bring in that LMS, whether it's a pre-made, like, again, Canvas, Brightspace, D2L, one of those type environments, Blackboard, or creating their own through a Teams or something like that. Why is it important for them to do that? And what benefit does it have to the student?
The benefit it has to the student is it, again, allows the student to personalize the education. Back when I was traveling all over the community college system, doing lectures and lectures on distance education and the efficacy of it and that it is valid, I distinctly remember a picture that I have of my traditional EMT class with a student with his head down asleep. And this student in my class, every class, would at some point do this. Did I bother him? He wasn't distracting the class. And you know what? He had one of the highest grades in the class. He wasn't learning that information from me. He was putting his butt in a seat because we told him he had to have his butt in the seat. He was learning some other time, because unless osmosis has changed that much over time, he was not getting it from me. So,
real quick, and if one of my senior lecturers hears this, it's not osmosis, it's actually diffusion, an area of higher concentration to an area of lower concentration. It's not the solute that's facilitating that. So it's actually diffusion. We were wrong all through high school.
Yep, yeah, absolutely.
The problem is, I know where he went to high school.
It's colloquialisms, they'll get you.
We went to the same high school, so.
Yep.
All right. So we're going to go ahead and wrap up for this evening. And so one of the things I always like to have you do, kind of give your final thoughts on the topic. So education, looking at the different modalities, what's your final thoughts on our topic tonight?
Final thoughts are, thanks to COVID, some eyes have been opened. Those that were shut may be a little tighter shut, but I really think that for everybody to simply just open your eyes, open your minds, and know that you can learn anything any way you want to, as long as you're willing to learn. If you're not willing to learn, you're not going to. That's the issue that we have. Traditional education, online education, correspondence, the whole goal is education, and the student has to want to do it. Intrinsic motivation, that's what drives the student. So that's, to me, the most important thing is for people to just open their minds and know that it can be done.
All right, Bradley, last thoughts for tonight.
So if you don't use online education in some form or fashion, whether you use it to as a supplement to your initial education, hybrid, then you're really not reaching all the students through all the different learning methods that are out there. Because, you know, if you think that you're lecturing in a classroom and the student's getting everything, they're going home, they're YouTubing it, they're looking at other stuff up. So, you know, you might as well incorporate those things into the classroom, and it helps the student actually help you overall, because they can help other students in the classroom. So use technology to your advantage.
Right. And I absolutely love this conversation tonight, because if nothing else, have this conversation now. Obviously, we knock on wood and hope that another COVID doesn't come around. But, you know, this action plan has got me thinking, you know, there's a lot of different things that we have to look at. So one, what if a tornado comes through and takes out a large part of your infrastructure and you have to shift? Obviously, it's not going to be, you know, for us, it was about 6 weeks we were off campus, maybe seven when COVID came through, but you lose an entire building, you know, it may be years before, you know, that on ground, or, you know, before another facility is contracted, and you don't want to wait the months that it's going to take. So make sure to bring that back, you know, have something to go to continue the education. And like you said, we do it all the time. You know, if we don't know something, we go look it up. And there's a lot of stuff that's figured out. I mean, from everything from, you know, how to make the best of your trip to an amusement park, or in my case, I've worked on things on both my house and my car from YouTube. So there's opportunities that are out there. Kelly, if they wanted to get a hold of you to continue this conversation, how are they going to get a hold of you?
They can send an email. My email is kelly@911elearning.com, or call our office anytime they want to.
All right, Bradley.
All right. So you can find me on social media, of course, on Facebook, or bradley.dean@handoffmedia.com. And you can email us there.
Absolutely. Mine is david.blevins@handoffmedia.com. You can find us on socials. Been doing a lot on TikTok until the government tells us otherwise. So if you haven't been there, but I'm trying to share out some different ways, we'll have some little teasers from all of our episodes coming up going through there. So until next time, remember the value of your EMS handoff.